Welcome to Scissor Tail Sessions. I'm Jacqueline.
And I'm Aaron.
Thanks for joining us as we share the threads that connect us all, simply being human.
This week is episode 6, and we speak with David Pizarro. He's an artist, a designer, and I don't think he'll mind me saying, an all-around creative genius. Currently, he's a puppet wrangler and a puppeteer for the Jim Henson Company.
David shares his story growing up, living in Oklahoma City, surviving as a musician, and his evolution in working with puppets.
You know, it was fun listening back to this episode and hearing all the random connections that we found with David during our conversation.
Yeah, it was really crazy hearing all the instances that our paths crossed, but we never met.
Overall, this was a really fun episode for us. It was a good conversation, so we look forward to sharing it.
For me, this was definitely a bucket list interview to be able to actually meet with someone that worked on Sesame Street. It was legit, and so I hope everyone enjoys it. Sit back, relax, enjoy this conversation with David Pizarro. So, do you have your own podcast, right? I see that you're launching one or had one or...
Yeah, had one. I mean, it's not officially dead. It's called Probecast. And it's like a satirical take on conspiracy, like ancient alien theorist kind of stuff. And it's this puppet character named Mackie Neckbone that he's a character I've had for like 4 years. And my friend Nate Brown and I, we're both improvisers. We decided to make a podcast for him. Like, what would that be like? And it started when we both, like, it was before the pandemic. And we were like both just needing something to make just to keep our improv, you know, juices going. And we started doing it. And then the pandemic hit when we were like 7 or 8 episodes in, and he didn't have any recording equipment. And so we just couldn't record anything. And now we're suddenly realizing like our Halloween special was a year ago. And that kind of like blows our minds. Like it's already been a year since we released our Halloween special. And it's kind of sad, but, you know, I think the pandemic has, it's changed everyone's life in such a huge way, be it, you know, displacing your life, losing loved ones. But I think there's also this like existential part of the equation where people have realized what's important to them, what truly matters. And I know I've done a lot of that too. And so in relation to the podcast, we've all just been kind of like not losing each other, but just sort of like going like, well, what is it that I really want to be doing? Like I'm here all the time at home. What do I really want to be doing? And, you know, I'm seeing people do some really, really rad stuff. So yeah, long story short, I sort of still have a podcast.
Yeah.
So you might continue that, but maybe change direction a little bit. Are you sort of like reassessing that, what you want to do with it?
Yeah. Like Nate got a mic and then we were going to do it. And then my microphone died. And so we were doing the show 100% free. And a lot of the hobbies that I do on the side, I get very ambitious. And when I'm doing a project, I really obsess about it. And if I don't have something that, like if the project isn't paid, I have this mantra that is, if I don't have it, I don't need it. And that's sort of like a punk rock approach to stuff. And since I don't have it, like I don't have the mic. So I for that podcast, I can't sacrifice good quality audio. Because a big part of what makes that show work is that you can hear us clearly, things sound fine. So sort of reassessing. And then on top of that, I started making clothes. And so I make my own clothes now. And that's become like a really big part of my life. So yeah,
that's cool.
We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, as you'll hear through my story, like I'm sort of driven by my own inspiration and my own intuition and gut. You know, I'm coming to learn in my 36th year, about to go into my 37th, that I truly am an artist. Like I'm not really one thing. Like puppetry has been a big part of who I am, but there've been so many different creative passions that I've pursued that have informed one and another that in 10 years, I honestly, I would love to be just doing the one same thing forever and be successful at it. But since I'm driven by my inspiration, I honestly don't know what that could be. And that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, that's cool.
So for our listeners, because I feel like I jumped ahead, you are currently in New York, but you're from Oklahoma. Is that right?
Yeah. Sorry. I guess I didn't realize that we were starting, but I'm into it.
Okay.
I'm totally into it.
We're pretty fluid in how we do this.
It's happening. We're doing it. No, this is great. I love it. Keep all this in. Don't cut any of it. Yeah. They have to know the truth. So I wasn't born in Oklahoma. I was actually born in Southern California. I am a first generation Latinx American. My mother came to this country from El Salvador, and she came here during the Civil War in El Salvador. If you're familiar with it, in the 1980s, there was a really big civil war that's still the country is still healing over now. And she came over when she was 16 and then had me. And I was born in Fresno, California. And from there, you know, I was in California till I was 11, and then we moved to Oklahoma. And then I moved with my mom back to California. And then I moved back to Oklahoma again when I was 16. And then after that, I stayed. I was in Oklahoma from age 16 to age 28. And Oklahoma is a big part of my life. Like, you know, from 16 to 25, that's a long time. And that's a lot of formative years spent in one place. And so I can't, even though I was born in California and California will always be a part of who I am, I can't discount Oklahoma in any way from my personal history. I am an Oklahoman, whether I want to or not. Like, it's just part of who I am. But yeah, I had no idea that I would be getting into puppetry. That was never when I was a kid, I didn't go, oh man, I really, really want to be a puppeteer. Like, I work with some folks who have wanted to be a puppeteer and be on Sesame Street since they were like 10 years old. And I find that really admirable. My buddy Evan, who's in Oklahoma right now, and maybe he's listening. Hey, Evan. He wanted to, you know, be a pilot when he was a little kid. And he is a pilot now. And he has an amazing, amazing history personal history as a pilot. And I find that just so admirable and incredible. And I'm so proud of folks that can do that. I, on the other hand, you know, even as a kid, I was just sort of driven by the wind, you know, like I, at one point as a child, I was really into drawing. I still draw a lot now. Like, it's, that's still a big part of myself and my creative endeavors, but, I wanted to learn how to play the piano. And so my mom at one point bought me a really cheap, you know, estate sale piano. And in Oklahoma, estate sales are essentially, you know, a garage sale. It's the same thing, right? Like, it's just, sometimes, you know, they put that fancy word on it to make it seem like it's going to be.
Yeah, it sounds like there's better stuff inside or something. But
right.
If you put the word estate.
It's the same thing. Like, it's all the same thing. So she got me this, like, amazing piano. And amazing. It was out of tune and very old. But I, you know, taught myself how to play piano. And after that, I wanted to be a filmmaker and an actor. And so in high school, I went to Northwest Class in high school. And I was going to go to class in SAS. I was going to apply, I ended up not going there because the Northwest Classen at the time, I don't know if they're still at this place, but they compete at a higher level at that time than Classen SAS did. And so I thought, well, as an actor, that's where I want to go. I want to go where maybe I'll be challenged a little bit more. And I did acting there. I was in advanced drama all 4 years of high school and did some community theater. I forget the name of the theater, but where that in Oklahoma City, there's the church that looks like an egg. There's a little theater, Jewel Box Theater.
Jewel Box Theater.
Yeah. I did some workshops and some shows at Jewel Box Theater. The director there, he was one of the first people that taught me how to have comedic timing. The first joke he ever told me that really helped me understand it is this classic joke in comedy, which is comedy is all about timing. Like, and that's just really stupid and really not that funny, but it gives you a sense of, like, you know, how comedy can be powerful when you give it time to breathe. And so from there, like when I got out of high school, I was a little bit lost and wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. My mother and my stepfather and my sister and my grandparents all up and packed up and moved to Africa when I was 18. And
what brought about that change?
Yeah, like how did you go from Oklahoma to Africa?
That sounds like a big move.
I didn't go there. I didn't go. I stayed in Oklahoma. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But what brought them there? What was that change that?
Yeah. So,
maybe that's tangenting off a little too much. I don't know.
Yeah. And anytime something pops up, you want to interrupt me, please do, because I can just ramble. But so that was an interesting part of my life. My parents and this is my stepdad's side of the family, her last husband, he and that family had started a church in Oklahoma. They started a church called City Church. And that church is now, my uncle doesn't own that church, but City Church left that big gold dome that's down on like Northwest 10th Street in downtown Oklahoma City with the stained glass all around it. I'm just giving you a backstory here, I guess. He has Frontline Church now.
Okay.
That's his church. And so that church building is the church that City Church was. And I was in there every day, you know, in high school. And my mother was highly involved. My mother actually did all the gold painting around the entire building and the dome. My stepdad designed all the stained glass and like all that stuff. Goodness. And so very involved in church as a young person. And they, when I was 18, they decided to, and I don't know exactly why, I don't remember exactly why, but they decided to go to Nigeria. And there was a bishop out there that needed help with his church. And they decided to move out there and go help him. And I, at the time, was at odds with a lot of things, like my creativity, my life. Like I was 18, like who knows what they really want in life at age 18, right?
Yeah.
And I was also being a little rebellious. I did not have the same religious faith that I had, you know, growing up. And I was trying to figure that out. So I was like, no, I'm not going. I'm staying here. I'm staying in Oklahoma and I'm going to figure it out. And so they left and my mom gave me the deposit for an apartment. And since they didn't need their car, I got to borrow the car and they left town. And it was not a great car. It was a 1983 Chevy Blazer that was raised in the back. My I don't know where my stepdad got it. It was not a great car. It was anytime I fixed the engine, I felt like I was using duct tape to fix that damn thing. But yeah, they left when I was 18. And that was a really, really tough time of my life. Not the toughest, but still very difficult. I was trying to figure out how to manage money, pay bills. There was a point where, I think this is illegal now, but I'm not quite sure if it was illegal back then, but this is gonna be like a dig on them, but OG&E cut off my power in the middle of winter when it was super, super cold. Because I couldn't pay the bill. Like I was waiting tables and I couldn't pay the bill. And the choice was pay the bill or feed myself. And so I chose to feed myself. And OG&E cut off my power. And I had to figure it out. I went to Walmart. And with a little bit of money I had, I bought another blanket and some oil lamps and a light to read my books. And that's what I did every single day. I think like 2.5 months until I had like enough money from tips to like pay off whatever OG&E needed. I don't remember what, but.
And so maybe you said this, but you said, where were you working at that point in time?
I was working at Abuelo's in Bricktown.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. We know. The one in Bricktown? Would that be the one? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I was at Abuelo's in Bricktown. And if you ever ate there, I guess in like, what was that? Like 2003, 2004, maybe. If you ate there around then and someone did magic tricks for your table, that was me.
You know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here. So my wife, she worked at Abuelo's. I'm pretty sure it was that time frame. We had moved back to Oklahoma City and she worked just briefly at Abuelo's. Anyway, I'm going to have to mention
Yeah.
Because she would probably remember you if you're doing magic tricks at tables and stuff. So,
yeah.
Anyway, okay. So, sorry. Just
another
side
do.
Thing like, there. But
I love that kind of stuff. I think that's amazing.
That's great.
So, as you're working at Abuelo's, freezing, are you going to school? Are you studying anything? What are you working on artistically?
Yeah, great question. And thank you for keeping me back on point on that stuff. But like,
that's her job.
Yeah, that's a great question because I was playing in bands and I was writing music. I would, you know, go to Hobby Lobby and buy as much paint as I could afford if I could afford it, and some canvas, and I was painting a lot. Because in high school, I was also doing a lot of art. I was painting and drawing a lot, and so that's what I was doing at home. And I would like give, I would have these big paintings in my house, and then I would just like give them away. I really didn't have a concept of like, I should sell these, I should show these. Like, I just didn't have any sense of that because I don't know why I didn't think of that. It just didn't seem like the right thing to do. So I was just like, I don't know, like, friend, here you go. You need this in your house. And so I was writing music. At that time, up until I was about, from age 18 to age 22, I was playing in a lot of bands. And I played in the band, I don't know if you know these guys, Student Film was a band I played in for a while. I was playing with them in the early days. Then after that, I played with a band called Stardeath and White Dwarfs, which that was for like maybe a year. It wasn't that long. It was a part of that first album. And then
isn't that one of Wayne's nephews?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Wayne's nephew, has a band still. I'm not quite sure if they're still playing shows or not, but, I was playing with them for a minute. And, then I had my own band called It's Hysterical, which was a fun little thing that I did for a little while I shouldn't say fun little thing. Like, it was really, really a good time. And, the people I was playing that band with are amazing artists and musicians. One went on to get his doctorate in chemical biology, actually.
Whoa,
so he's smarter than us all. So that gets me up to like age, like, I don't know, like 23, I think. And I, at that point, knew that music wasn't quite what I wanted to pursue. I was living in Norman, Oklahoma, in a house with a bunch of artists. We had 5 bedrooms, and we had a skateboard that my buddy Tim had painted, that a skateboard deck that we put above the door that said, "Welcome to the bungalow. We have fun and games." And we called it that because we lived in a bungalow and we wanted to like have a name for our house.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to have a sense of just like play and fun. And Tim and I, you know, we're still this way now. Like, we would talk about this a lot then, about how the way we like to pursue art and creativity is through funism, which is just like have fun and express fun and share joy and touch people with that joy. And so we wanted when you came into our home, for it to be fun immediately. Like, the word bungle means to like trip up, to mess something up. And like, a lot of times when you're creating, you need to mess up a little bit to make something good. You can't, can't be perfect. And so that was a part of our mantra and part of the joy that we tried to share with anyone that came over. So we had quite a few people come through and live there with us, which was pretty rad. He's running, my gosh, I'm just thinking of, my brain is running really fast and I'm blanking on his name and I feel really bad. Sam Worgan. Sam Worgan lived with us for a little bit. And he's now running for city council in Oklahoma City. And like, that blows my mind. Not because like he's, you know, weird or bad, but like, we were just a bunch of like skinny artist kids barely getting by.
Yeah.
And now he's running for city council in Oklahoma City. And I'm so proud of him because he's really like doing a lot of like rad civic work in Oklahoma City. So to watch him grow has just been awesome. And then, yeah, that house has a lot of fun. Fond memories, a lot of fun stuff happened there. So anyways, I'm gonna keep going.
How long were you in Norman before you transitioned to whatever that next phase of your life is?
I was in Norman for let's see, I want to say 4 or 5 years, I think I was there. I got there when I was about 22, I think. And then I think I left when I was 25 or 26. Somewhere around there is when I left. And yeah, I moved around quite a bit there. I think I lived in maybe 4 different houses in Norman, just like all of us weird art kids did back then, you know? And there were so many good musicians and artists in Norman at the time. I don't know what the scene's like now, so I can't really speak to it, but at that time there were a lot of really rad people there. All the guys that are in Broncho now were all in Norman, and we were all like collaborating with each other. Blackwatch Studios was going strong at the time. And we would I remember once I was saying to those guys, like, hey, I just need like some space to record something. And they're like, all right, we'll leave the keys above the door. Go do whatever you want at these times and just go play. And so I'd like run in there and like record music and just do my thing. But it really was like a collaborative, supportive community. We all just wanted to see each other succeed in art. And there was no real jealousy, you know, like the only jealousies that really came in was like the interdating that happened, you know, and that happens in small communities.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, we would get over it, you know, people would get over it, move on. And, a few of us were proud that we didn't really do much of that, you know? But it was still wonderful. We still like all shared and we're so kind to one another and still are, like, we're, you know, you see these people and I'm sure you have them in your lives too, where you see them and you're like, oh my God, like I'm right back where we were, where we left off. Being, you know, kind, wonderful friends. I love that. I love them. So the next thing that happened that was a really, really big turning point in my creative and personal life was George Salisbury is the guy who does all the art and all the like videos for the Flaming Lips, right? He's one of the guys, but he's like the main guy. Like he's the guy, right? And I had friends that were close with him, and I was learning how to use After Effects and motion graphics and animation stuff. And I had asked somebody like, hey, I'm trying to figure something out. Like, who should I talk to? And like, oh, go talk to George. Here's his number. Give him a call. So I called him up and I was talking to him, and we were talking off and on, you know, about random things I'd ask, like, you know, how do I make something look like this? And he would give me some tips or some resources to look at. And one day he was like, oh, hey, you know, if you know somebody who would be interested in like doing an internship with the Lips, let me know, because we need someone to just like help with a lot of random stuff. And I was like, well, me, that person is me. Like, let me come help. Him and I were on the phone and I told him, like, he said that he needed an intern. He was like, it's not going to be fun. Like, you're not going to be in an office. You're going to be sitting in a corner on a computer in my house. And I was like, I'm fine with that. That's totally great. You should see my living conditions. Like, it's fine. And he was like, okay, well, then you're going to come in like twice a week. You got to come to Oklahoma City and you start like next week. And I was like, great. So I was also, I didn't mention this. I was also enrolled at the Academy of Art in San Francisco. They were the first art school that had online classes.
Okay.
And all right.
It's not the Art Academy. It's the Academy of Art. Like the other one is the branch that has like a bunch of branches all over the country. I went to the one school that's in San Francisco. And sure. I'm only saying that because the other school I don't really like. They're, you know, kind of a pyramid scheme. But like this school, I was doing it online. I was doing traditional illustration and animation. And I knew once I was talking with George that I didn't want to do traditional illustration anymore. And I was like, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for me to sidestep out of, you know, school and just do this instead. So I started doing that. And I worked for them for 4 years. I created backing videos, music videos, animations. I also created original illustrations and toys for them. I did everything. My title was visual generalist, and it really was that. Just like anything visual, we would make that. And it was me and George just in his house for, I think, a year and a half, maybe 2 years. I'm not quite sure on the timing on that. But my very first job right out of the gate was doing all the subtitles for Christmas on Mars.
Yeah.
And
It was not fun. Like it was great to watch the movie and like really like, you know, I'd have to like rewind stuff and see it over and over again, but like it wasn't fun at all. You know, like I'm having to like type in all this stuff, and then I also had to translate everything, and I didn't do it well. Like I don't know how well I did, but I used Google Translate, and this is back when Google Translate had just come out. So who knows? I think I did it in Spanish, Russian, French, and Chinese, maybe.
Oh my God.
And wow. It was just bad. I don't know if it was good. And
Christmas on Mars in Chinese. Like, how do you, I wonder, culturally speaking, how does that translate to them? Like, what do they see when they watch Christmas on Mars?
I don't know. And like, I could be wrong. Like, I may not have done Chinese. It was such a long time ago, but I do remember there being like, there was definitely Russian, because we all laughed so much at how like what happened was we would translate it into Russian, and then George was like, let's see if it actually works. Let's translate it back through Google Translate and see what we get. And it was always something a little off or completely wrong. And there was like, this is a part of what I really have enjoyed and what I took from growing up in Oklahoma, is that there is a rebelliousness and an anarchy that is sort of embraced in a lot of the artists in Oklahoma, where it's almost like comedic. Like if something goes wrong in a slightly funny way, it kills us and we just laugh about it. Like we love it. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of like what would happen when I was with the Lips. Like if something went a little wrong or would confuse the audience, but like still engage them, that was kind of like a part of the mark we'd want to hit. Like, yes, yeah. That is fun. Like that is cool. You know, if the guy in Russia is watching the movie, now I think about it and I'm like kind of embarrassed by it. But like if he's watching the movie and they're saying, the guy's like holding a baby and he keeps saying like, you know, grandma, like that's kind of funny, right? Like,
yeah.
That's kind of funny. Yeah. We know it's not a baby. We know he's saying grandma and grandma's incorrect, but that's kind of funny. So I was working with them.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things, I have so many good memories with them. And one of my favorite things was George and Wayne were really such wonderful mentors for me. George and I worked together for so long and got pretty close that things got a little shaky towards the end, you know, as they do, which just happens. That's family as well. Like that happens in family, but mm-hmm. I learned so much from George and I learned so much from Wayne that I still carry through what I do today. Like, when I had this great memory of when I was working in the house, in George's old house, Wayne came over, and Wayne often will sit next to George an entire 8-hour day, just them, George driving the computer and Wayne just like watching and collaborating, because he looked very close to the work. And when I was in there, I was working in the other room, and then Wayne comes out and he's like, hey David, we're having this like debate and I want you to come be a part of it. And so he pulls me in, which is often what Wayne will do, or George will do too. If like, you know, it's sort of like mom and dad are having a disagreement. And they brought the kid in to like in a buffer, you know, that's really what was happening. But the discussion was something that really impacted me. Like Wayne says, you know, we're discussing the clay pot theory in a creative process. And for those who don't know, like the clay pot theory is like, do you make one perfect pot and that's all you focus on? Or do you make 100 pots until you find a perfect one? Like, which is the one you do? And Wayne is very much on the like, make 100 pots and then until you have a perfect one. And at the time, George was arguing like, no, make one perfect pot. Like just focus on the one and make it right. Mm-hmm. And Wayne was quoting this book that discusses that, where they actually did that test at a school, at an art school, and found that when a student made just a tons of pots and released that anxiety of making just one perfect pot, they usually made something really innovative. Hmm. Whereas the one pot was good, but not quite as technically good as the one that someone had just made over and over again till like it was in their bones and they knew how to innovate and change. And so when I was brought in, I was like, well, of course, 100 pots, like, of course. And so then we all like spent like a good hour just like going around in a circle talking about that. And that has stuck with me for a long time. And that has become a part of my creative process, where instead of just trying to be absolutely perfect in the one thing that I either do creatively or the one thing that I'm making, I will make variations and I will experiment and try it different ways until I discover something.
Yeah.
You can't, like, it's perfection is impossible. All we can do is strive for it, but we will never, ever find perfection. It's just not going to happen.
And it sounds like it kind of goes back to your original philosophy of making sort of lemonade out of lemons, or whatever, however the saying goes, that you try to take those mistakes and you turn them into something that's more creative or something unique and new and different.
Yeah. Like that's something that I learned from working with the Jim Henson Company, actually, was, I should back that up. Working with, the first puppet company I worked with, Puppet Kitchen, my mentor there, which we'll get into, but my mentor there, he was the one that was like, you know, embrace the mistakes and don't call it a mistake. Call it a style choice. Like, this is a stylistic
choice.
And so when you think of it that way, you can then, your perception changes and you start to see other things differently too. Like, I'm teaching myself how to make clothes, and I was trying to do a really perfectly beautiful hemmed cuff that was like rolled and you couldn't see the seams and all this stuff. But since the leg is tapered, the fold would, the crease would fold over on itself. And there was nothing I could do to prevent that. That was just how the fabric was folding. But when I was doing it, because I have this perception of embracing what the material wants to do and not seeing it as a mistake, but as a stylistic choice, I just leaned into it. And now it just looks like a really clever fold within the pant, and it looks nice. You can't even really tell. So as artists, I think we have to do that. We have to embrace the mistakes, because I mean, I'm starting to get real deep now, I guess, but like, life is chaos. Like, the universe is chaos. Like, nothing about it is perfect. Everything is insane. And we're going millions of miles through the cosmos on a big giant Earth spaceship. Like, we can't expect our little tiny speck of a painting to be perfect. Like, that's asking too much of our materials and of ourselves. Anyway.
And that's all just kind of amplified in a way by the whole pandemic thing that's going on. It's like, you kind of have to make the best of the situation that we're all in. And it does seem like there's a lot of artists, whether musicians and painters, that have actually been sort of more inspired during this period because they're forced to look at things in a different way or to just really be with themselves, it seems like. So we're all looking for an outlet.
Well, especially when I feel like now people are experiencing having limited resources, not like financially and such, but options are just not available when you are hanging out at home all the time. And so you're having to get more creative and think outside the box.
Even
quite
if
a
it
bit
is
more.
Just baking bread, you know, if it's just, you know, people going back to the roots of what they were doing in their earlier days, in some sense, of being creative and making things that are functional or meaningful to them, that like, I don't know. I think the baking bread to me encapsulates it all in a way, because like how many people out there were really doing that to the extent that they're
nobody
doing that now? And now, you know, you see all these Instagram pictures on like these perfect, and I think David, you even have a couple of pictures of pretty nice looking bread on your feed. I'm like, whoa, that looks really intricate there.
Yeah. I got into it, man. Like, I, you know, when the pandemic hit, I, like a month later, my wife and I went through some of the hardest stuff we've ever been through our entire life. And I didn't realize it until now, but the baking was me coping. That was me just like trying to get a handle on myself, trying to control something. And when I look back and I see all the people that have started baking, like I think that's part of it. I think that's part of why people started baking. They needed something they could control and they could afford to control. Like you can buy a 2 pounds or more of flour for like $5 and then some yeast for $2. And that's all you need. And some water. Like, that's like, you suddenly become an alchemist. You're suddenly a wizard, you know, with a really low investment. And that's what I realized. And I was like, I'm going to just start making bread. And I went crazy. Like, I made a challah that I was really proud of. And I also, like, when I jump into things, I will choose the hardest thing to make. And that is like one of the hardest things to make. It's a brioche bread that is then tied and braided.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't do no three braid. I didn't do a four braid or six braid. I did an eight braid. I was I'm going for an eight braid. I do not care. I'm going to control this and make it work. And luckily it worked. but now I know how to make bread, and I often make fresh pasta for my wife and I. Like, I have that recipe in my head now. And I think that, you know, one thing that the pandemic has taught me is that how important home ec is. Like, that's actually a really important class that we got rid of. And it's not just for girls. Like, it is for everybody. Everyone should know how to bake. Everyone should know how to cook. Everyone should know how to sew. That's just, everybody should know these basic skills. Because you can't just rely on paying for everything that is in your life. You can't rely on that. And I think that we do rely on it a little bit too much.
We'll be right back.
So did you meet your wife here, or did you meet her where you went next?
I met her in Oklahoma. Yes. Thank you, Jacqueline, for keeping me
back
on schedule, on point here. So I met her in Oklahoma City. I was living, by that point, I had moved from Norman. I was riding my bike from Norman to Oklahoma City to go work for them. And eventually, I was working every day of the week in Oklahoma City. George ended up hiring me to work in the office. They built their own office on the compound there in what is now the Arts District, which blows my mind. Back then, we'd hear drive-bys weekly. And now it's the Arts District.
Yeah.
Every time I go there, I'm just like, ooh, it's so nice now. And I see everyone happy and walking around. And for some reason, that makes me mad. And I don't know why. I should be happy for them. But I'm like, you don't know what it was like. It was hard. I couldn't walk down the street by myself. Stupid. But anyways, I was then living in Oklahoma City in a really horrible apartment near the Paseo District, and it was full of cockroaches. It was bad. Constantly, I'd come home to a guy just asleep in the hallway or asleep in the front yard. That's where I was. And my wife was working on a documentary that was called Women Behind Bars, I believe is what it was called. Was that the run?
I think.
Oh, yeah.
Beasley one, not that one. But her friend Amina was directing a film about the incarceration of women in Oklahoma. And
this is going to sound really lame, but was it featured on OETA?
Yes, it was. I believe it was.
Okay. I know which one you're talking about.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I know of the documentary as well.
Yeah, I should guys, don't tell my wife that I can't remember the name.
She'll never hear this. It's okay.
Yeah. She's in the other room. She doesn't like hearing me talk about myself, so she probably will listen to this. But
she's locked herself behind bars. Apparently,
please don't tell her. Okay. So we met while she was working on this documentary. She was producing it for Amina. She was looking for someone to do motion graphics, and she was referred to me. She went and looked at my Vimeo and liked one of my videos, and I was like, who is this Cassandra Ketrick in my videos? And I stalked her on Facebook that was still icky then, but I went on Facebook and I was like, who is this cute lady here? Who is this? She is beautiful. Who is this? And so we can't remember who, we need to look back again on our Facebook messages, but either I messaged her first or she messaged me, and I was like, how do we have so many mutual friends but have never met? Who are you? And we started talking, and she was like, I run in Edgemere Park every other day. And I was like, oh my God, I run there too. Maybe we'll run into each other. I was like, what part of the neighborhood do you live in? And she kind of told me whereabouts. And I was like, okay, this is getting weird because I live in the same area. I'm not going to come over to your house, but what are your cross streets? Cross streets. And I was like, okay, I literally live one block away from you. We have to hang out now. I told her it was a moral imperative. We have to hang out. And so she was at a place where she didn't want to date anybody. And I was in that place too. And what's funny is she tells people that she tried to dress as much like a man as she could when we went to like go have a meal together. So she like wore her OU hoodie and then put a trench coat over, didn't do her hair, didn't do her makeup, wore like baggy jeans. And when I met her, my first thought was like, well, hell yeah. Like, this is awesome. Yeah. Like,
that's what I'm looking for.
She's like not worried about anything. This is cool. You know, like she's just like into herself and does her thing. This is rad. And so we had dinner and I was really impressed by, you know, her philosophy on life and her outlook. And she was saying how she was training for the marathon, the Oklahoma City Marathon at the time, and was saying how like she's doing like 6 months of celibacy and she like doesn't want to date, doesn't want to flirt, all this stuff. And I connected with that because when I was living in Norman, I went through a really bad breakup just as she had that inspired her to do that. And I took like a year and just didn't date anybody. Did the same thing. I was like, I can flirt, but I can't be intimate. I can't date anybody. I'm just going to like take a year and get to know myself. And so when she told me that, I was like, you're even more amazing. Like, oh my God, this is so rad that you're doing this for yourself. So we would talk on the phone. After that, we were only allowed to talk on the phone to each other. And when it comes to dating, I always loved like the gamification of rules within a relationship, you know, like of saying like I dated one woman, and when we needed to have space to work or be creative on our own, we would declare radio silence in a text message. And that would be the key to say like, we're not talking for a while. And that's fun. Right? Like, it's fun to have those little bits between people, you know, like, and so Cassie and I, we didn't date, we didn't really do anything, but what we did do was watch X-Files together via Xbox Live. Because back then you could like get online and watch videos together via Netflix, and your little avatars would go into a theater and sit down in a theater, and you'd see this little tiny screen of the video and you'd watch it together. You'd click your buttons and they'd do little motions funny. At each other. It was really fun. I don't know why they took away that functionality. I loved it. But we watched all of X-Files together over that 6 months via Xbox, and which was kind of dating, but not really. So anyways, she knew she was going to go to New York, and she wanted to go to New York because her mother is originally from New York City or from New York. And her mom had left New York when she was young and moved to Oklahoma, but then went back to New York to pursue costume design. And she was a costume designer here in the 1980s. She has all these amazing stories of how she like met Andy Warhol in a post office. She also worked on Shakespeare in the Park. She did wigs for cats and like did a lot of really rad stuff. And she was here and in New York for only like 4 years. And she went back to Oklahoma because she decided that New York really wasn't for her, and had Cassie. And so Cassie was born in Jinx, Oklahoma, which is a
we know Jinx.
Part of Tulsa. Yeah. And so she wanted to go back and kind of connect with her mother's history. And I knew that I wanted to go to LA, New York, or go to London. Like those are the three places I wanted to go to pursue my career, to expand my career. And so I was like, well, you know, we decided that we would date, but we knew that there was like this limit, you know, there was a term limit on our relationship, and we were okay with that. We were like, okay, well, that makes this great. Like, there's no pressure. Like, we're free to just kind of be us and do our thing and enjoy our friendship and all that. And so we, sorry, I'm laughing at myself for some thoughts I'm having, but, I went to LA, with the Lips, and it was for the cemetery show that they did out there in Hollywood Forever. And I went with them, and that also took some time, I think after or before the show, to like kind of check out LA, visit some studios, see what's going on, and decided I really didn't want to live there. I was like, I can't, I've lived there before as a kid. I don't like LA very much. I don't like the culture there very much. And so I was like, it's not for me. And the job I was trying to get at this company called The Mill, they would just never return my messages. So I was just like, well, okay, that's not going to happen because I can't just go to London. Like, that's not going to work. And so the other option was New York. And I was like, okay, well, Cassie told me that one of her films was going to premiere, or not premiere, but was going to show in New York City. And I was like, well, that's great. I'll go out there a week ahead of you and I'll just like go visit people, get a sense of the city, visit some studios, see if this is where I want to live. And then when the week's up, you'll be there and we'll go to your premiere and or go to your showing. So I did that and immediately was just like, this city is incredible. I love the energy. Meeting a lot of the artists, I was like, these artists are unbelievable. Just the way that they think and kind of approach stuff, even just in casual conversation. And I knew that this would be a great place for me to expand as an artist and as a human. And so I told her, I was like, well, I think I'm going to move to New York. Like, I think that's what I'm going to do. And she's like, cool. Well, you know, we can't live together. So she said, she's like, we can't live together. I was like, I agree. No, we can't live together. We're going to move in our own apartments. We can't live together. I think everyone knows where this is going. But
on Xbox, you can live together on Xbox, but then you can't actually live together. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
We can, if we only had like, what is that neighbor crossing? That like Animal Crossing? If we only had that back then, we'd be like, well, we can live there. We can live there, but not, you know, together. God, I just sounded like an old man just then. What's that game they play?
You know, way back when.
What's that? Is that Zoo Crossing? Is it Kitty Cat Place? What's it called? I don't know. I need applesauce. Anyways. We were out there. We were here. We had a good time. We went back and decided that we were both going to move together. And not to get too into the weeds of telling too much of that story, but like her apartment got infested with fleas and they couldn't figure out why. And so she ended up moving in with me because she couldn't stay there. She had two cats and she just couldn't stay there. And we both agreed it would be temporary, but then it turned into like, you know, us moving to New York together and living in the same apartment would be just much more financially stable. And it just kind of made sense. And so we were like, okay, well, we'll just do that. But actually, I need to back up just a little bit because I skipped where I started doing puppetry.
Yes, let's get back to the...
Yeah, and what kind of... And yeah, let's get back to that. And then what kind of job, too, were you looking for in New York and in LA? And maybe that ties into the puppetry thing.
Yeah, so I was looking for... At the time, I was doing a lot of motion graphics and visual effects. And I really thought that that was going to be my industry. I was like, I'm going to be working at the top-level motion graphics agency doing visual effects and like animations and all this stuff. And making my own short films. That's what I thought. And while I was in Oklahoma, I had left working for the Lips and was trying to figure out what to do. And I reached out to Jonathan Fowler and on Facebook, and I was like, just thought I'd throw a Hail Mary his way and was like, I found this video of these puppets and I was like, hey, you need a car commercial like this. That's all I said. And he was like, could you do that? And I lied and said, of course I can do that. Yes, 100%, I can do that. And so we had a meeting and talked about it. He asked me how much money I needed and I told him and it was really casual. But he was like, all right, well, and at the time he was like, I'm wanting to start this thing where we have guest artists come in and be creative directors on our commercials. Like that was something he really wanted to do. And I love Jonathan Fowler so much. He's such a big part of the arts community in Oklahoma. And he was also a supporter of me when I was doing music. Like when I was playing in student film and he met me for the first time, he like flipped out because he's such a like music nerd. He was like, oh my God, David Bizarro of student film. I was like, what? Like, yeah, what? Like no one talks to me like this. Like, who are you? And, but he's just like, he's so in love with the arts and the music scene in Oklahoma. And I really appreciate him for that. So
like Norman Music Festival, it wouldn't be what it is today really without his support.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Like he is such an integral part of Oklahoma's success in the arts. So he hired me to do these commercials and I had to learn how to build and perform and write for puppets in like a week and a half. And so I started making these puppets and I discovered that I really enjoyed making them. And I was doing animation, like character animation at the time too. And the immediacy of performing a puppet was the thing I was missing when I was animating. Cause when you animate, you have to hit render and wait and see what it becomes and then make notes and change stuff. Like you can render within the space, but like it's not as kinetic. Like it's not happening within the moment. And I'm also a performer. So being able to perform the character to find what it needs to do just fits better with the way that I am as an artist. And so I really loved the puppets and decided that I would kind of pursue this on the side. I would keep doing motion graphics, but I pursue this on the side. So when I was in, when we finally moved to New York, my wife landed a job before we got here because she's incredible. She works for NYU and is now like the communications director at Stern, which is the business school there. Like, wow. She's big time. And so I kept working in motion graphics and doing visual effects and doing that from home and worked remotely like we all are now, but was able to do that from home. And then on the side, I was doing puppets. And what I started doing like right out of the gate was I met with the New York City Puppetry Guild. I started emailing people locally saying like, hey, I'm trying to learn puppets. Could I come meet with you? And one of the people I reached out to was Michael Schupach of Puppet Kitchen. And I said like, hey, if I gave you like $100, would you just give me a class on patterning, like patterning a puppet? And he was like, of course, yes, 100%, come learn. And so I went down there and for like 3 hours, he talked about how to pattern a puppet.
And what do you mean by patterning a puppet? What do you mean by patterning a puppet? Tell me what that means.
Great question. Okay. So we'll talk about Elmo because he's the most well-known puppet I think that we could talk about right now. Elmo is built out of several materials. He's built out of fur and he's built out of foam. And there's also some wood in there, some plastic. But when I talk about patterning a puppet, I'm talking specifically, if I were to say that to somebody, they would know, like another puppeteer, they would know I'm specifically talking about the understructure, which is the foam structure of the puppet.
Okay.
So Elmo has a foam head, which we call the skull. And then he also has a torso, the body, and the arms and hands that are all made out of foam. And this foam is the same foam that they use in air conditioning filters. It's called a reticulated foam. And it's kind of like porous, but still has a good structure to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you pattern, you use a method typically called flat patterning. And that's where you get a piece of paper, you draw the patterns out and you cut them out and then you place them on your foam, trace that out and then cut your foam out. And you take basically a glue that's used for gluing shoes together and you glue the seams together. And just like on like even on this doll, like you see these seams and how we have these different seams. And once you stuff it, it kind of makes this three-dimensional shape. That's the same way that gluing the foam together for like Elmo works. You glue it together and it creates this round, beautiful shape.
Okay.
And that's all from a flat piece of foam. So working that way is a bit mysterious. Like there's one school you can go to in the country that I know of called the University of Connecticut. And they teach these techniques, but I couldn't afford school. I was already in debt by like $9,000 just from trying to go to art school. And so I was like, I'm not doing that again. And I reached out to the studio and he graciously was like, yes, of course. And Michael and I hit it off and he became my mentor for a while in how to build puppets. And I would go work at Puppet Kitchen every now and again. They would do a thing called monitor nights where a lot of puppeteers who are learning, we'd all come over to come together in their workshop and we would just practice our monitor puppetry. And monitor puppetry is what is done for TV and film. It's kind of what we're doing now, except when I'm down here and I'm doing this and I'm talking as a puppet, this is monitor puppetry. That's what this is.
Yeah.
And so this is, that's
we monitor.
Can do the rest
of the
interview.
Let's do the
rest like this.
So we would get together and we'd bring our puppets and we'd lift each other up and we would like do drills. Like when you're learning how to do puppetry, you'll do a thing where you just go through the alphabet and you'll just say like A, B, C, D, and you'll go through the whole thing. And then you'll go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and you just do these drills. And what that does is gets you good at using your hand to say words. Because here, we'll do a little tiny mini lesson here. So when you're performing a puppet, like you watch me talking, when I open my mouth, my jaw goes down. The top of my head doesn't go back and up, right? Like my jaw goes down. And so when I'm performing a puppet, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to keep that thumb to go down. I don't want this and I don't want that. Because when I do this, the back of the head is going to go up and back. And that's going to make the head flat back. That's why when you see a puppet and you're like, oh, that's bad puppetry. It just doesn't look good. That's what's happening. The person is doing this because they haven't had the training to know that they need to do this. And you'll also kind of see my hand curving. The reason mm-hmm. is not because I'm trying to hold a grip or anything. It's just that you want your hand to be as relaxed as possible so that when the puppet, when the character walks, their head kind of like has a bounce, and that's just moves around like that.
That's so cool.
You know, and it has a little kind of a bounce, and you can move and talk and like move your hand around. And that's basic puppetry. So together, we'd learn. And from there, I started making my own stuff. I did a show called The Bear Show. And that my friends and I were shooting out of my friend's apartment in New Jersey. We did that show for about 4 years. And it was a lot of fun. It was really, really hard, but I learned a lot. The puppet I built, I still have. And it's one of the worst built puppets. But out of all the puppets I've made, it's the one that everyone loves the most.
Yeah.
And which is funny to me, because like I recently built a puppet for the Sci-Fi Channel, and I kept in mind what I had done for Bear as far as like what worked for him. And also a lot of the techniques that I learned from the Jim Henson Company, and it all kind of came together with that one character. So how did I get to the Jim Henson Company?
Yes.
So when I was working with Puppet Kitchen, and Michael was my mentor, I asked him one day, I was like, hey, like how do I get to a point where I can like just do puppetry full time and like perform on TV? And he's like, you just got to put it out there. You got to talk to people, got to get to know them. And so that's what I started doing. And I met my friend Liz Hara, and she's incredible. She's a great puppeteer. She's now like pitching these show ideas to people in LA. Like, she lives in LA. She's an incredible writer, writes for Sesame Street. I love her so much. She's listening. Liz, I love you so much. What's funny is we have this joke where like anyone who knows her who is on a podcast always names drop her, because we all love her so much. So she's doing that now too. Like, we're all trying to like,
we'll start name dropping too.
We should.
Yeah.
Like, we just, everyone in this community is just so lovely and beautiful. But I was talking with her, and we started doing a thing where we would meet like once a month at least to do an early morning breakfast. Because we both get up very early, and we both love breakfast. So we would get up at like 6 a.m. and go meet at a cafe and have breakfast and just talk about where we are in life and like what we're hoping to do next and how are we feeling. Because her and I both, you know, live with anxiety, and being able to have somebody to talk about those specific things and what we're dealing with and what we have found that works or doesn't work is really, really has really been beneficial for both of us. But one day I said, like, you know, I feel like I need to expand as a builder. And I feel like the only place I'm going to get that is if I work in a shop. And I said, besides Puppet Kitchen, are there any other shops you think that I could like apply to and try to work at? And I didn't have Henson in mind. Like, they were not in my mind. So I was just like, I'm never going to get there. Yeah. And she was like, you know, and why don't I give you Melissa Scott or Melissa Crichton's information. She's one of the people that runs the shop here in New York City, and you reach out to her and I'll let her know you're going to reach out. And Liz was at the time working fairly regularly at the Henson shop. And so she let Melissa know, and I reached out to Melissa, and Melissa was like, you know, we're not hiring, but why don't you come in for an interview so we can at least see you and see what you've done. So I was like freaking out, and I packed a duffel bag full of puppets and emailed them my portfolio and got over there. And there I am sitting, you know, at this handmade table that was like made by one of the Henson family's friends, next to a stained glass window that's got Jim and Frank and Bert and Ernie on it. And Oscar the Grouch is over there, and Snuffleupagus is over there, and there's a bunch of Fraggles over there. And I'm there with a duffel bag full of crappy puppets. Just like, what am I doing here? Like, what is happening? And so we talked, and Jason Weber, who's another one of the lead guys at the shop, was like, you know, we don't have a place for you right now. But you're very interesting to me. But we're not quite sure what to do with you yet. But if we need you, we'll let you know. And part of the reason why I think I was confusing to them was because I was doing really well financially as a motion graphic artist. And they asked me straight out, like, what's your hourly rate? And I told them what it was as a motion graphic artist. And they're like, we don't pay that. Like, we can't pay you that. And so to sort of convince them to hire me, I was like, well, don't worry about taking care of me financially. I just want to work here. And I just want to learn. Yeah. Like, that's the biggest thing I want to get out of working with you is learning. And they're like, okay, that's good to know. Because they, you know, Melissa also feels responsible to make sure she can hire people within the community and pay them, because there's not a lot of puppet work out there, and she feels some responsibility for everyone in the community. So I wanted to like help her know that you don't have to worry about me. I'll just let me worry about me and just hire me so I can learn. So about a month or two went by, and I had an opportunity. And the reason I'm telling this detail is because I feel like it's spooky and fun and important. But I had this opportunity to collaborate on a sort of case study for a short film that a friend of mine was working on. And they went to Jane Henson's house. So Jane Henson, Jim Henson's wife, when she passed away, she was building a house upstate, and she wanted it to be a space where artists that the family knew could go up there and like work on whatever they're working on. But it was still a family house at the same time. So this artist was invited to go do a case study of his short film. I was invited to go too. And so I was there helping out because of my video background. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Got to be around like all this history. There were like original, you know, Muppet Show records and like original Jim Henson art and like just amazing stuff to be around. But the next day, like we were there for about 3 days. I went home and told my wife about it. It was amazing. Went to bed. And then I woke up the next morning at 7 a.m., look at my phone, and there's an email from Melissa that says, hey, can you come in today? And it was so surreal. And I woke my wife up and I was like, okay, Cassie, you know how I was at like Jane Henson's house yesterday? She was like, yeah. It's like, the Jim Henson Company wants me to work for them today. They want me to go work now. Like, what? What right has now. Happened? I was like, did the ghost of Jane Henson have to approve of me first? Like, what is going on?
And that's part of the interview. They do that for everyone, I think.
Pre-screening.
Yeah, yeah, that's a part of it. Yeah, that's their version of hazing. Is like, you got to go spend like a night at the Henson house. And so it was nuts. I felt like, you know, Charlie from Charlie the Chocolate Factory. Like, I rushed and threw my tool bag together and hopped on the train and went to Queens, because that's where they are, and started my first day at the Henson Company. And it was incredible. Like, everybody there is so kind and loving and mischievous as well. And open to sharing their knowledge. I've learned so much over the years working there. There is a job that I do there sometimes called being a puppet wrangler. Yeah, puppet wrangler.
Okay.
And it sounds weird. It sounds like I'm corralling a bunch of like puppets that are running amok. But what it is a it's hair and makeup for puppets, essentially. And what we do is we maintain and take care of the puppets when they're not on set and when they're on set. And we also take care of the props that the puppets directly interact with and the costumes they have to put on and off. So let's say Elmo's on set and they're doing a bit, and all of a sudden he gets a tear in his shoulder in the fabric. They send him to me. I very quickly on set do a hand stitch outside on his fur, and then I send him back on set. And I have to do that quickly. Or if a puppeteer is having an issue with a prop and can't quite figure out like why it's not working, I will quickly come up with a solution to help him or her. And we, a lot of times, will collaborate with the puppeteer to make something work better. Or if like the prop isn't quite reading right, we'll come up with a solution for that. And so a lot of us have either been working in the industry for a long time or are puppeteers ourselves. And that helps us better understand what they might need in the moment. Because the puppeteer can't be expected to know how to do everything, you know?
Yeah.
So we're kind of like part of their brain in a sense. So I took that job. Like, that wasn't what I was originally hired for. When I first started, I was working on costumes, even though I have had zero experience making clothes or costumes, but I learned quickly. And so one day Melissa was like, you know, we need a puppet wrangler, but it's not a job people like doing. The hours are long, they're hard, but would you be interested? And I thought to myself, you know, an opportunity to be on set and like watch the greats, do their job and learn from what they're doing. Of course I'm going to do this. And so I started working, and one of the first jobs I did was working outside in the hottest summer New York has ever experienced, and working with a bunch of basically fur coats. And it was really, really hard. Wow. And the hours were really, really long. And puppet wranglers, you know, we stand on our feet about 95% of the time that we're on set. Like, we don't get to sit a lot. And, but you learn so much. I learned so much in such a little amount of time by, as a craftsman, you know, having to sew with my hands very quickly, having to solve problems within the moment of, you know, puppets construction or a props construction. And then also watching puppeteers on set, you know, do their job and figure out problems in the moment. Because as an artist, you know, you can only learn so much when you're in your little bubble. You have to go mm-hmm. out and be in a shop or just sit and watch somebody work. You can see their process when they're working. Which is part of why I love the idea of, you know, the YouTube university, like people posting videos about how to do stuff is so useful because you get to see them work. And that's really beneficial as a creator. So yeah, but I think my favorite memory is taking Snuffleupagus across the busy streets of Soho. Like that.
Oh, that's cool.
Was nuts. That was crazy. And Marty Robinson, who is the puppeteer who plays the front part of Snuffy and does his voice.
Okay.
I was warned ahead of time, years ahead of time, before I even worked for them. I was told by my mentor, Michael, that if I ever worked on Sesame, Martin is going to mess with me. Just be ready for it. And because it's what he did to Michael when he first started working with them. And we're on the busy streets of Soho. We're at the middle of like of rush hour traffic, and we had to cross this very busy street that goes right to the Lincoln Tunnel, I believe. And so we're there, and usually we take the puppet off the puppeteers, we put it on a big rack and we roll them off, and that's fine. We're like, it'll be fine. But we realized we didn't have time to get him on the rack. We had to get him off set, and he's big, and the production had to like halt for us to get him off. And so we're like, okay, well, you know, it was kind of like a Fox News moment. You know, we were like, well, fuck it, we'll do it live. And I told Marty, I was like, okay. And usually when a puppeteer's in a suit, we talk to them as if they are the person. So I was like, all right, Snuffy, we're going to go across the street together. That's how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay. You know, and like, all right. Yes. And so I kind of like stand next to him, and I didn't know that he could see when he opens his mouth. I didn't know how good his vision was, and nobody told me ahead of time. And so we get to the street, and I was like, all right, I'm going to, you know, let you know when to go, Snuffy. And I was like, all right, okay, let's go. And he goes, okay. And he just starts running across the street and not like avoiding cars. He starts running towards cars. And I was like, Snuffy, no, no, no. And I like jump in front of him, and I'm like buzzing around him like a bee, just trying to stop him from like running into cars. And I have this memory of him like doing the thing where he like runs and like kind of, like he's going to, I'm going to run into it.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't know. I was panicking. I'm like, this is a new job for me, and I just want to make this work. And I'm trying to like make.
You don't want to kill Snuffleupagus, basically.
Yeah. And like, so we finally get across the street, and Marty like takes off the suit and looks at me and has this smile on his face. And I was like, oh no, he got me. Like, he totally got me. He was fine the whole time. And there's this wonderful photo that I took where I'm running across the street, and I look and I see the head wrangler, my friend Michelle, another amazing, beautiful person. She's there and she's smiling and kind of laughing. And it was in that moment that I'm starting to realize, like, I think he might be messing with me.
Yeah.
And so I snapped a photo, and it's just great because you see her smiling and looking at the ground, and the camera's really blurry, which is clearly me freaking out still. but that's one of my favorite memories amongst the many, many memories that I have working with them and working on Sesame Street.
Help us grow this podcast by giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes and posting a positive review. Spread the word. If you have friends or family that might like this episode, send them a link. We really appreciate you listening. Now let's get back to the final segment of our conversation with David Bizarro.
I guess you also did the, so you do puppetry, but you also did the Not In Here story with Tracy, Zeke.
Yes. Yeah. I did the Not In Here story.
Did you do those illustrations?
What's that?
Did you do the illustrations for that, or?
Yes. Yeah. She wrote the book and I did the illustrations for it, which I actually started illustrating before I moved to New York. And
okay.
Her and I met in Oklahoma, and I don't usually like let people hire me to do illustration because illustration is really kind of like close to my heart. And it's something that I do for myself and for loved ones. And when I talked to her about her story, you know, she's just like such a radiant ball of joy that I was like, I really want to work with this person. And then when she started telling me about the story and her background and how it's based on her story, but she's using it to help other parents, you know, learn how to talk about adoption with their kids. And that really spoke to me. And I was like, well, I have to illustrate this book. I have to work with this woman. I have to be a part of this book. And so I illustrated it. And the idea behind the illustrations was to make something fun and playful, but also make it look like the illustration is obtainable by a child. Like, this is something that if a kid were to look at it, they'd go, you know what? I could draw this too, you know? And so not to make it look like it was drawn in crayon, but just that the drawings aren't really complex and kind of easy to grasp for a kid. And so that's what we did. And we also, you know, collaborated on like what was being seen in each of the images, you know, like in the start of the book, they're sitting in a living room with no pictures. And then after they do their trip, they're sitting in their dining room and like you can see a picture of all the places they visited. And that's just to kind of like, you know, help whatever child is looking at it, like connect back to the bigger story of their life and how, you know, they're adding aspects of their life to their home. But for those who don't know, like when it comes to someone who is adopted, oftentimes, you know, kids are not told they came from another human being. They came from a building somewhere. And it's really important for the mental development of a child to know that they came from another human. And not knowing that can do some real harm. And so this story is to help children know that, like, even though they were put up for adoption, it doesn't mean they didn't come from a human and that they didn't come from a place of love. And that their new mommy, like, or new daddies, like, didn't take them away from somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, this was an act of joy for them to be adopted. And that really spoke to me when she told me that, because I didn't know that when I was getting into doing the illustrations. And I was like, that's incredible. Like, I really want to be a part of helping not just parents learn how to express that in a healthy way, but also to help kids know that, you know, they're not a weird, I don't want to say, what is the word? Like, anomaly. They're not some weird anomaly that came from a building. You know, I know I've had those feelings, you know, as a first generation kid that is half white and half Salvadoran, like I've never really fit in anywhere. And I, you know, grew up not having a direct community. And so I know what it's like to feel like I'm a complete outsider. And so that really spoke to me when she wanted to help all those kids. I love that book. If anybody listening has a kid that they've adopted, like, get this book or check it out. Because it's just really sweet and a wonderful story to share.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know this, but my son is actually adopted, and I got that book after he was adopted, just because, you know, I'm in Oklahoma City and it's a small community, so I know of Tracy and knew that you had done the illustration. So I was just really curious, I guess, to read it and see the book. And that is true. Very briefly, we'll derail this, but with Max, we from the beginning have been very open about, you know, you came from a birth mom, not a hospital or a building. So that's interesting that you say that, just because I feel like there's so few people that have adopted or are adopted. So it's just not something that's talked about a lot.
Yeah. And I'm so happy that to hear that you have that conversation with your kid, because it's so important to be open and honest with everybody, you know, with children and everyone else. And I think that there's definitely, and I don't want to harp on like American culture or American society, but just like humanity in general, we have a hard time talking about our feelings and talking about the truth of things. And if we don't talk about that at an early age, we're not going to know how to talk about that when we're older. And
yeah,
we're seeing that in our country right now from all sides of the conversation. You know, everyone is just mad at somebody else and doesn't really know how to talk to people about anything. And communication is the reason why my wife and I haven't split up. We've been through a lot of loss this year, like a whole lot of loss in not this year specific, but like from this time last year to now, we've had a lot of loss in our lives. And if we hadn't worked on teaching ourselves how to talk about stuff that's really hard to talk about, we wouldn't have lasted. And I have friends, you know, when I was a kid, I had friends who lived in an orphanage, and some friends that were adopted. And, you know, I have memories of them always having a hard time confronting any emotional moment. And being a man, like, and growing up in a Christian, you know, a household, being a man, like, I didn't know how to talk about my emotions, you know, because we're not really allowed. It's not even like we're allowed to be emotional. It's more like we have to walk it off. You know, it's like constantly like, oh, walk it off. Like, you'll be fine. Muscle up, like, you know, just like basically bury it down. No pain, no gain. But it's like, you know, it's the pain that really makes us better. So why is it like, why aren't we allowing ourselves to talk about it and be open about it? Because when we do that, we end up being better than the people who don't talk about it. And being vulnerable is really what's made me a better artist today, for sure. Anyway, I
it seems like it takes a lot of that too, with puppeteering as well, because like in a lot of ways you're putting yourself out there with these characters that you create. And I mean, of course, people identify puppets with sort of the stuffed animals and with children and kids, but I've watched a few of your videos, and the way you translate using puppets to the adult world, I think is really interesting that you make that transition, you know, that people still as an adult can identify with a puppet like that. It's really cool.
Thank
like
you
even
very
with
much.
The Pitt short film, that I think that really, it could speak to the younger demographic, like, oh, this is a cute story, but an adult would watch it and I assume take the true meaning behind the storyline.
Yeah, that was a big part of the goal of that film. When I was writing it, I wanted it to not have any words. I didn't want any dialogue. And that was a deliberate choice, because I wanted anybody from either someone who can't hear or someone who doesn't speak the language that it's in, like is from another country, I wanted them to also be able to enjoy it. So the biggest goal of that film was just universal appeal. And that's also why like the two characters in my mind are genderless. Like, I know that one has a pit, and generally we think of that's the lady, because that's the pregnant one. But like, that's not how I see it. There's some people that were like, oh, it's the boy because it's putting the thing in the other thing. And it's like, okay. Well, that's how you see it. Great.
Yeah.
But I really wanted these two characters to be genderless and for anybody to be able to watch it and kind of get it. Mm-hmm. And when you watch like early Henson stuff, his stuff wasn't meant for kids. Like, they dealt with a lot of adult issues, but they were never like, oh, it's these two people having a romantic, intimate affair. Like, they're kissing and now they're having sex. Like, this is adult. Like, I really don't like this idea that if you're making something that is adult, well, that means there's got to be like sexual organs involved, or someone's got to have sex. People have to cuss. But it's like, you know, that's not what it means to be an adult. That's like just an addition that's the addition to being a kid. Like, adults are basically children who are kind of able to do whatever they want. Like, that's really what it is, right? Like, what I'm saying is that I wanted this to be understood by anybody, and I really appreciated Jim Henson's approach to not making anything sexualized to make it adult. And so this film was a test at doing that. It was a test to see if I could make something universal, but also make something that an adult could watch and really connect with, but also children could watch and really connect with. And we premiered at the New York Children's International Film Festival, which was amazing. I got to watch it. The first time I watched the film was in a giant theater with like 100 plus kids. And the thing that made me so happy was that, you know, the kids were talking through a lot of the films, not all of them, but some of them. But when my film came on, everyone just got quiet.
Watched.
And at first I was like, uh-oh, they don't like it. But then at the end, all the kids were just like raving about the avocado. And I was like, okay, maybe it's working. Maybe this is working. And as we went on, like, I'm so proud of that film because it did touch a lot of people. And we had one person at a screening come up to us and say, like, this was my coming out story. Like, this made me think of what it was like coming out to my family. Mm. And I heard other people say, like, wow, this is how I met my partner, or this is how I confronted this aspect of my life that I didn't really appreciate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the storytelling method in that was just very straightforward and very basic. And I think that, you know, that speaks to how storytelling doesn't have to be complex for it to be relatable. Like, you can take something to its simplest form and still connect with people. So I'm really proud of that one. And
yeah, that's cool. Yeah. How did you come up with the idea of using an avocado versus something else? Or did you have any other ideas that you're like, yeah, that could work, but probably not?
So it started with a conversation I was having with my friend Kathy Kim. And what happened was we chat on GChat often, and like, we'll send each other stupid pictures. And she sent me this picture of two felted avocados holding hands. And we started riffing on, like, what are they doing? Where are they going? Like, we came with this whole story. And we started talking about how sad it would be if there was a puppet, you know, not a puppet, but an avocado with no pit, walking down the street, putting stuff in its pit and trying different things. And as we were talking about that, I stopped and thought about it. And I was like, man, that is really beautiful. And that is kind of like my life. I'm constantly trying to put different things in my pit to try to figure my life out. And, you know, nothing really works when you try to like force something in your life. It only works when you kind of like, it really, really, things only come together when you kind of like let them come to you, right? And not in all cases, of course, but, you know, generally in life, like, that's how I met my wife, for instance. You know, like, I met her not because I was like looking for somebody, you know, I just kind of like let life happen. So I asked her, I was like, do you mind if I take this story and run with it? And she agreed. And I initially wrote like a big story where the avocado like went walking in a park and saw a bunch of other fruits and vegetables all hanging out with each other. And they had someone special, and like, there was dialogue and like all this stuff. And the more that I sat with it, I thought that it would be better if there was no dialogue. And that's when I was like looking at Jim Henson's older work. I was looking at older short films and of different, you know, filmmakers, and was noticing how the ones that I connected with and resonated with the most were the nonverbal ones. And the ones that like if you look at some of the best Pixar short films, there's no words in them. Yeah. Like, that bird short film is one of the best short films. And there's no dialogue in it. It's just birds making chirp noises, but you know exactly what is going on, and anybody can watch that film and get it. And I was like, you know, that's what I want to do. That's really what I want to do, is make something anybody can enjoy. And so that's how I came to that realization.
So, I mean, in my book, you've made it because you worked on Sesame Street and Jim Henson. So what's next? Do you have any projects on the horizon?
Goodness. I have, I do have a concept on the horizon, and I did recently win an Emmy for my work on Sesame Street, and that is still really surreal. I don't, you know, I have that imposter syndrome. I don't fully believe like I deserved it, but it
you
happened.
Totally do.
And it's
totally
crazy. But like the thing that the Emmy has done, which is pretty great, is that it's sort of like when you get your doctorate, like it's really qualified me in the eyes of a lot of people. And one thing I've started doing is starting to work with organizations that are like working with kids in El Salvador. And I've found myself like the pandemic has done a lot of stuff, and the civil rights movements that have been happening recently mm-hmm. have also changed a lot of people. And one of the things that it did to me was it helped me reflect inward and start to think like, I can't just sit here and feel bad for myself for not knowing my Salvadoran community. I need to like find them. And I'm discovering that all of these kids from the 1980s that were displaced from the Civil War are starting to find themselves and find each other. And we're all starting to collaborate and make stuff. And so one of my next steps that I'm hoping to do is just do more work with them and help inspire, you know, kids that are like me, but now, you know, like when I was a kid, I didn't know of anybody like me making stuff or see people like me on TV. And so I'm trying to get in front of these kids and also adults that may need that inspiration too, to help show them that, like, you know, I don't want to say anything is possible, because I feel like that is a little too flighty, but to think that, like, if you believe in something and you want to do something, just work hard and you can do it. Like, it's not unattainable. It just means you've got to work, and it is, but it is possible. And so that's one of my big things that I want to be doing now, with what I've done with my career. And I've got a concept for a sci-fi opera that involves toilet paper roll puppets that I want to do. That's the next thing I'm working on. And I'm playing with some technology, called virtual production that could be a lot of fun. So to rewind just for one second, when I was 18 trying to get the mill, ad agency in London to hire me and wouldn't hire me, I now work closely with the mill. Now that I'm in New York,
that's cool.
Three years ago, I got connected with them through my puppetry. And so I'm not working with them as a motion graphic artist like I thought I would, but I got hired for them because of my puppeteer experience.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
And did you remind them that you applied earlier and that they never gave you a call back? Did you talk to their HR department about that?
I never did, but I did mention it. I did say, yeah. when we were, so they've developed this really rad technology where it's basically digital puppetry that happens real time. It's incredible. And it like renders these CG characters in real time while I use my hands to puppeteer them.
Oh, wow.
I was telling them that after I was hired, of course. I was like, you know, guys, I once applied here when I was 18 and you guys never got back to me. But I was like, but now look at this. Like, look where we are now.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm working for you. And the fact that I have a digital background really helps in the communication process. And so I've now been collaborating with them on this technology for the past 8 years, or not 8 years, sorry, 3 years. And that's been incredible. So more of that in the future, for sure. I've been working with the Sci-Fi Channel on this puppet character named Mr. Scribbles and hoping for more of that in the future as well. And I've been making clothes.
You mentioned the clothes. Tell us a little bit about the clothes.
So I made a jacket for a puppet and was like, if I can make a puppet jacket and it looks this good, can't I make clothes for myself? And I made a jacket and a dress for my wife, for my wife and I. I got the jacket, she got a dress. And then I was like, maybe I can pattern clothes. And so I recently like drafted my own pattern for a pair of trousers. And I was like, I'm now going to kind of see where this goes and see where this takes me. So right now I'm having fun just teaching myself how to make clothes and make clothes for my wife. But I am curious about how this is going to change me as an artist. Like, I'm envisioning really good looking clothes that I make for my puppets. Like, maybe I do some weird sculptural things, you know? Oh God. Oh geez. Uh-oh. I just hit my computer. That was scary. Cause I thought I closed the window.
You're good.
Woo. Okay. But yeah, like doing maybe an art installation where I build crazy fur monsters, but they have like beautifully tailored outfits. I don't know.
Oh yeah.
Like
we were envisioning that you had some like puppet pants or something like that, like furry puppet pants.
Maybe that's the crossover, you know? But yeah, that's kind of where I am now. And I'm excited to see where this takes, you know, myself and what we do next. I'm teaching workshops as well. I've got a series called Bizarro Workshop or Bizarro's Workshop. And on my Instagram page, I've got a link. And if you want to learn how to, right now I got one coming up called Hand Sewing, and it's all hand sewing for puppets. This will probably air and it'll be over, but I'm going to have more. So if you're listening to this in the future, check out my Instagram page. It's just my name. And I'm sure I'll have some more workshops at that point. You can come learn how to make stuff.
That's awesome. I feel like really you're cool. Just like on the verge of a personal evolution. And hopefully our listeners will be able to experience that with you.
Yeah, I hope so too. Yeah, I was telling my wife the other night that like I feel like I'm starting a new chapter in my creative life, and it's really, really exciting.
And my daughter will be happy that you're doing cat videos as well. So we'll, I'm sure, watch some of those too. Are you still doing the cat videos?
I made the one, and one of the stars of that cat, this like I was doing a sitcom but starring two cats on my YouTube channel. The lead actress passed away over the pandemic.
And oh my gosh. So
that kind of put a halt on doing the cat video, but my wife will sometimes post videos of me talking with my cat Charlie because I will ask him things and he will respond in meows, and it's the cutest thing ever.
You just can't go wrong with cat videos.
I think everyone really loves them.
You can't go wrong with it at all. So.
Well, I just want to thank you again for joining us. This was awesome. You're an amazing individual, and I know you're not from Oklahoma, but I'm really glad that we were able to say that we had you here for a bit.
Yeah, it's great to meet you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I love what you both are doing. And you know, even though I'm not originally from Oklahoma, I do consider myself an Oklahoman. And, you know, we come back often to visit, and, you know, we hope that one day in the future we'll be able to maybe come back and be a part of that community again.
Well, we would love to have you.
Well, thank you.
If you like what you hear and want to support the show, find us at scissortailsessions.com.